You're listening to Let's Talk Creation.
All right, welcome back to another episode of Let's Talk Creation with Todd and Paul. I am Todd Wood.
And I'm Paul Garner.
And we are here continuing our discussion from the previous episode on the Dead Sea Scrolls. And we have back with us Dr. Jeremy Lyon, who is professor of Old Testament at Truett-McConnell University and president of the Creation Theology Society. And he has graciously agreed to spare us another hour of discussion of the Dead Sea Scrolls. So thank you so much for coming back, Jeremy.
Pleasure to be here. Thanks, Todd. And thanks, Paul.
Oh, it's great to have you.
Yeah.
You don't, by the way, you don't exactly have to twist my arm to talk about the Dead Sea Scrolls.
I didn't think so.
So last time we basically set the scene. We talked about how the scrolls were really one of the greatest discoveries in archaeology in a long time, maybe even ever. We talked about where they came from, who wrote them, and how they were discovered. We talked about a little bit about what they mean for the biblical text. But we never got to, you know, what do they mean for creation? And this is Let's Talk Creation, not Let's Talk the Dead Sea Scrolls. So we did need to cover that. And frankly, it's going to take another, you know, at least another episode. So here we are back again. Now, getting started here, I wanted to come back to one issue that we sort of covered in the last episode, and I wanted to make sure I understand and clarified what you were talking about there. You were talking about the plurality of textual traditions at Qumran. So you mentioned that there was what you called a proto-Masoretic, which is essentially the text that was preserved by Jewish scribes that we now use as sort of the primary basis for translating the Bible into other languages like English. And then you mentioned that there was something called the sort of a proto Septuagint.
And I know the proto, it's the Hebrew text.
It's the Hebrew text underlying the Septuagint. Yeah. So the Septuagint being the ancient Greek translation of the Old Testament that was made in the years prior to Christ, that is actually quoted verbatim numerous times in the New Testament. And then there was the Samaritan Pentateuch, which is a really curious document that we didn't really understand the history of it too much. But there are readings of the Samaritan Pentateuch that are preserved at Qumran as well. Okay, so I thought maybe it would be helpful. Two issues here, and we'll see if we can get this done. One issue is, does the existence of these ancient multiple versions of the Old Testament, does that threaten our reliability on the Masoretic, right? So if there are these different readings of all these verses, is that somehow a dangerous thing that we really don't know how the original one was written? You know, we don't know which version is the right version. Or is there something in the Qumran text, the Dead Sea Scrolls, that can tell us, well, this one was probably the more authoritative one, and these others were maybe sort of weird variants that they didn't really know what to do with? I don't know how to ask that question. And I thought maybe it would be helpful if you could illustrate this with some examples of the variations that you see there at Qumran that can help us to understand, you know, how is this a problem or is this something minor? So can you elaborate a little bit on that as we get going here?
One, it's nothing that threatens our understanding of the reliability of the scriptures. I think we mentioned that in the previous episode. What I mentioned is we've got what I refer to as the stable text tradition. Mm-hmm. So our earliest extant text, our earliest existing text, all the way back to 250 BC, the earliest Qumran text, we have the proto-Masoretic text, that text tradition that the later Masoretes preserved during the medieval period, which our modern Hebrew and English Bibles are based upon. Right, so we're reading the same text that they were reading back 2,000 years ago during the Second Temple period. Now, that text tradition is present from the beginning, and we have quite a number of these manuscripts that attest to that. This is actually a good thing. Not only do we see the reliability of the transmission of the text there, that stable text tradition there, we also see at Qumran, we have readings there, Hebrew texts there that actually exist, which confirm the translations in the Septuagint, that they were actually translating conservatively from a Hebrew text tradition that actually existed and differed from the Proto-Masoretic text during the Second Temple period. And that's actually a good thing, right? So these Jewish scribes, they weren't making it up as they went along. They weren't winging it. They weren't making mistakes there necessarily, right? They weren't giving it some interpretation for whatever reason necessarily. We actually have textual evidence that they were faithfully and conservatively translating from a Hebrew text, Vorlage, a text-based text, something that existed during that time. And that's good news because the New Testament often quotes the Septuagint, for example. And so the Dead Sea Scrolls actually validate the Septuagint as a translation, early translation of the Hebrew Bible. And then the Samaritan Pentateuch, as you mentioned as well, this is just a early recension, or it's another text edition of the Hebrew text there. So it's just another a revision or recension, which they add, essentially bringing parallel material in or so on. And of course, the one that we're aware of. So far from being a threat, I see this as a wonderful opportunity in studying the Word of God. And so those who value, as I do, the Bible as the Word of God, ought not be threatened one bit. But this is actually very exciting news, which confirms the biblical text in a number of different ways.
All right. Creation, the flood. We've covered the significance, I think, pretty well for the issue of the actual text of Scripture, but I really wanted to get into, and this is part of a lot of your research, and that is what do the discoveries of the Dead Sea Scrolls tell us about how ancient Jews in particular would read Genesis 1 through 11? Are they going to take sort of an imaginative approach and have a local flood, or maybe say the days of creation aren't really 24 hours or something like that? Or, what do we got? What do the scrolls tell us about how these ancient peoples would have read these passages?
Yeah. So, tell you what, we had this window into, Second Temple period, Jewish interpretation, which we did not have before. This is absolutely phenomenal. So we get to peek into and learn from the ancients. And yes, they speak, and in fact, creation and the flood both play pretty prominent in a number of texts here. So we'll just deal with them one at a time, I suppose, as best I can. These ancient Jews were employing the biblical text for various purposes. So when we talk about interpretation, right, what we don't find at Qumran is something like your modern day commentary, where you have text, comment, text, comment, text, comment. The closest thing we had to that, we do kind of have some text like that at Qumran. And those are the ones known as the Pesherim. That's plural for the term Pesher. And I mentioned that a little bit in the last one there. That's where, and I want to bring that up because there's different types of interpretation. So I want to clarify what we're looking at here. We've got that. We've also got thematic commentaries, right, which differ. And then we've also got rewritten Bible, which is very fascinating. Interesting things in the biblical text itself as well. For example, with the creation account that addressed the issue of perhaps interpretation. And so one of the issues that I dealt with in looking at the creation account at Qumran is the scribal practices that we see evidenced in these manuscripts. This is another thing that's, I mean, we don't have to theorize, by the way, about what scribes did.
Yeah.
We can actually look at what they did. We have actual manuscripts that we can actually look at what they did. It is remarkable. So one of the things that they did, we talk about these sense divisions here. And so they would divide the text in different ways, kind of like akin to what we do in modern day with paragraph divisions and so on. And so they would divide text a certain way. And by the way that you divide a text, the way that you might organize a text that way, says something about the way you understand the text, the way that you group certain things together and so on. That is an interpretive move. And so the scribes would divide the text in different ways. So we have what we call a patuka, which is a large or an open section break. Okay, so this would mark major text units. Okay, so how the scribe would mark it, he would, let's say that the last line of that section there, there has to be enough blank line left. So if there's sufficient amount of blank line left, they would leave that blank, and then they would either start the next section on the next line, flush against the right margin there, Hebrew goes right to left. They would start the next section on the next line because there was sufficient amount of blank space at the end of the previous line. Or and in addition to it, if there's not enough blank line, then if it's too close to the end, not sufficient enough to indicate, hey, this is a major break here, they would either indent the beginning of the next line, give it a sufficient space there, or leave that next line entirely blank altogether to make clear to the reader that this is a new textual unit. They also have what are called a satuma. A satuma is a small or closed section break. So this subdivides the large textual unit. So you have the large text unit, which is then subdivided into, right? It's broken down into smaller units. So we have this large unit, which can have A, B, and C, if you will, right? Mm-hmm. And so what they would do there is that subunit would come to an end in the middle of the line. They would leave a couple of blank spaces and then continue that larger unit on that same line, right? So those are what we call a satuma, or the plural satumot. So the scribes would do that in those ways. There's also other markings and stuff they did, but we won't get into that now. The scribal practices in the creation text. So we have, this is beautiful. We actually have two texts, 4Q Genesis B and 4Q Genesis G. Two texts here from, you're talking the turn of the era, 2000 years ago. 4Q Genesis B is a beautiful text there that preserves the majority of the creation account. As I mentioned in the last episode, it is identical to the Masoretic text. So as you read it, it's beautiful. But what you see there, and also with 4Q Genesis G, you're going to see this as well. You'll see the first major sense division, a patuka, occurs after verse 5. Next one occurs after verse 8. The next one occurs after verse 13. The next one occurs after verse 19. The next one occurs after verse 23. You know where those are. Those are at the end of each day of creation is where they place these major sense divisions there. These what we call patuka. So interestingly enough, as I look at that, that does tell us something about how either the initial author, the initial composition of the text was divided that way, or at the least, a scribe from the Second Temple period was reading it that way and hence dividing it that way. Mm-hmm. So one of the things that I find interesting here, and we don't know because we don't have the original, we don't have the autograph, so we don't know. We have some early texts. These are the earliest ones we have. It's pretty awesome, but we don't have the autograph, so we can't say with certainty whether it's part of the original composition or whether it's a scribal interpretation, if you will. Is that at the least, you have verses 1 through 5 all as a single text unit, which seems to indicate that all of verses 1 through 5 are included as the creative acts of day one. That means the creation of the heavens and the earth in verse 1 is part of the creative acts of day one. What we have here is positive textual evidence here of a unit of text that, with no suggestion whatsoever that verse 1 and or verse 2 was read distinctly or separate from verses 3 through 5. That is, there's no indication from the scribe or in the text in any way that verse 3 begins a new unit. Right? There's not a patuka, there's not a large open break, and there's not a satuma, a small closed break there either. This indicates here that by the way that the text is shaped, right? by the divisions there, right, that they read verses 1 through 5 as a single text unit. Now, I find that to be very important, by the way.
Yeah, me too.
We need to kind of spell this out for listeners who are wondering what the significance of this is. So, you know, we have talked in a previous episode about this thing called the gap theory.
Yep.
And this idea that that the original creation of the heavens and the earth is somehow separated by a long period of time or an indefinite period of time from the events then of day one of creation. And in effect, you know, what you're saying is that actually this is a single unit. This is all part of the events of day one, that we don't see this, at least in, if it's a scribal interpretation or if it was there in the original autographs, we don't see evidence that people were reading it in that way, that there are actually two, because you'd expect then to see two units of text with a division between them, but actually they're portraying it as a single unit of text. So people can go back and listen to our episode on the gap theory, and this is very significant for that discussion that we had.
And by the way, this is really neat because taken straightforwardly, right, the positive textual evidence, right, the physical evidence, the positive textual evidence there, it really indicates that the first five verses were understood as constituting the creative acts of day one. So here's an interesting thing here, how within a biblical text itself, we have interpretation on display, whether it was part of the original composition by the shaping, the sense divisions there, or a later scribe, an ancient one at that though, in our oldest extant text we have. That's about as good as it gets, by the way. So whether they add that there or not there, I'm going to give you a quote here. James Barr, it was reviewing a work on Patuka and Satuma. It seems so dry and academic and blah. No. This is exciting. This has real impact on how we understand the Word of God and His creation and so on. But he makes he in reference to this work, James Barr observed that, quote, a detailed investigation of an apparently dry and technical textual matter can lead to far-reaching consequences for the understanding of the Bible, end quote. I would agree wholeheartedly with such a statement. I think this is an example that we see here in this text. Now, we're used to thinking of interpretation of the biblical text as something that happens within text. So a rewritten text, which we see at Qumran, or in dialogue with the biblical text, the Pesharim or modern day commentaries, text commentary. But we look at an actual biblical text here from Qumran, and what we see is these texts, before Genesis B and D, and actually the other ones as well, these two just actually preserve the day one text there. The other ones preserve other parts of it as well. But these Genesis texts from Qumran actually highlight how interpretation also happens around the text at a scribal level, which is actually quite interesting to look at. While we're on Genesis 1-5, another example, and that is, of course, from the Book of Jubilees. Now, the Book of Jubilees is another popular book at Qumran, and we see this by its influence in other texts and also by the just the volume of copies we find there at Qumran. So a lot of copies of Jubilees there, and we see its influence there in other texts as well. So as we look at the Book of Jubilees, it's a retelling, a reworking there, Genesis 1 through all the way up to Exodus 19. And it's basically this revelation to Moses on Mount Sinai via the angel of the presence there. A really interesting retelling here as it goes through from Genesis, from creation, all the way up through the Exodus there. Jubilees was originally composed in Hebrew, translated into Greek, and then subsequently translated into Latin and Ethiopic. Okay? Now, the book is preserved in its entirety only in the later Ethiopic texts. You know where I'm going with this, right? So we had no extant Hebrew text.
Yeah.
Until the discovery of the Dead Sea Scroll. Oh, yeah. By the way, it also showed, because they prized the Book of Jubilees. In fact, there are a number of scholars that think that the Qumran community may very well have viewed the Book of Jubilees as canonical. And so it's interesting because some of these texts are actually part of other canons. It's not part of the Protestant canon, but some of these texts of Qumran that aren't part of the Protestant canon are actually part of the Ethiopian Orthodox canon, for example. But anyways, the Book of Jubilees, the reason why I bring this up, in its retelling of the creation account, it does something very interesting here as well. For day one of creation, it mentions a total of seven great works of creation on day one. The heavens, the earth, the waters, the angels. That's interesting because the Bible doesn't talk about when they were created. It doesn't specifically mention it. Mm-hmm. But Jewish tradition often places it on day one, not prior to creation, but during creation week, so that the angels don't get any credit. There's a lot of theological reasons why. But anyways, it mentions the heavens, the earth, the waters, the angels, the abysses or the depths, the darkness, and the light. So as you read this, that's interesting. So you can discern the biblical text when you read the retelling. It's very clear that you're reading, but of course they also add some things there. But it talks about seven things created on day one. So, which by the way, the heavens, the earth, the waters, that's verse one, that's verse two.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Which by the way, then means they understood consequently verses 1-5, the author of Jubilees understood verses 1-5 as constituting the literary boundary of day one. All five verses are part of the creative acts on day one. And so that's part of a reworking, a retelling there in the Book of Jubilees, for example, there for Genesis 1-5. And by the way, that has important implications as well. Without getting into all the grammar and the syntax, which I would argue is sufficient, this just shows that from antiquity, they appeared to be interpreting it this way as well. And this also, you mentioned the gap theory, but what has gained more traction today really is the idea, not so much the traditional ruin reconstruction gap theory, but kind of this modified gap in which you have, of course, day one beginning in verse three, wherein some of them view verse one and two, you know, verse one as a heading, if you will, not necessarily the original creation. The problem is in either of those views, you've got pre-existent matter prior to day one beginning. So that's a problem there in either of those views. But nonetheless, it's a view that has gained a lot of traction in recent decades there, this idea that verse three is the beginning of day one. And the argument they make is because it begins with the vayiktol, just like the rest of the days of creation do. Well, there are lots of vayiktols in the creation account, and many of them, and there are a number of cases where they don't begin at the beginning of a day. The vayiktol is just simply giving us a sequence in the narrative there, which is expected at the beginning of each of the subsequent days of creation. There's no reason to expect a vayiktol at the beginning of day one when it's the initial creative act. But anyways, nonetheless, we have interesting extant evidence, actual ancient manuscripts, a biblical text, and a non-biblical text here, interpreting it, if you will, that seemed to give us evidence of how the ancients were viewing verses 1-5 as part of a single text unit.
Excellent. Now, Paul, do you know
that's fascinating?
Do you know what a vayiktol is, Paul?
Well, I was going to ask for the benefit of our listeners, Jeremy. You should just explain what that is.
What is a vayiktol?
Well, a vayiktol is a verb that its primary function, though not exclusive, is to move narrative forward sequentially in a narrative there. It has other functions as well, though, so without getting into all the nitty-gritty.
But it's a word. I mean, it's a Hebrew word that gets, what is it, translated and God? Or
the vayiktol, the verb beginning verse 3. So in English, translated, and he said.
Okay.
The Hebrew word, a single word, vayomer. Then he said.
Okay. So vayiktol is the form of that. Okay.
That's what that is. Yeah. So three words in English. It's one word in the Hebrew. Vayomer.
Yeah, that's very succinct then. All right. how about the flood? You got any bombshells for us about the flood?
I got more on creation.
Okay, well never mind then.
In fact, there's a lot more on creation. We simply don't have time for it all. Yeah. But another interesting text that I just as a sample, because we don't have time for all of it. A sample is a text known as 4Q504 or Divrei HaMe'orot, or the words of the luminaries. The luminaries, right? The sun, moon, and stars are sometimes referred to as the angelic beings and so on. But in 4Q504, this is a liturgical text. and for instruction, and provides prayers for each day of the week. Right, so it's got a particular structure here as a liturgical text in which they call upon the Lord, and then they recall his great works in history. And then based on his great works and acts in history, they then make their request known to him, whether it be physical deliverance or some kind of spiritual protection or something. And then it concludes with some type of benediction, if you will, type of thing. So you have the 6 days of the week in which it does that pattern. And it takes you all the way, and it goes consecutively in order from the events in the Bible, from creation all the way to the exile, post-exile, right? And then the seventh day, Shabbat, or the Sabbath, actually has a different structure. And it's more this hymn or collection of hymns, if you will, or a single hymn with multiple stanzas, depending on how you view it. So it actually differs from the other 6 days of this liturgical text. Kind of like in the creation account, where day seven differs literally, not because it's somehow this continued day, but because the Sabbath is holy. It is set apart from those other days. And it actually, in the biblical text, does that intentionally there, literally, to further distinguish the Sabbath day from the 6 days of creation. It is set apart. It is holy. Even literally, it's done that way. Here in 4Q504, the Sabbath day has a different prayer. It's a hymn of creation, if you will. So it kind of brings it back full circle. On the first day, it has creation. So it's one of the great days. It talks about the creation and the fall of Adam. So one of the first things you see is a couple things about Adam, right? This has been a controversial, it's kind of recycled, if you will, this idea of the controversy about the historical Adam in the last really 20 years here. And so here's an ancient text, just as an example. Well, how are they looking at this stuff? Now, were they asking the same questions that modern, you know, people are asking? No, they weren't. But we can, from what they wrote, from what they said, discern what their views were, and we can deduce certain things. So one of the first things we see, similar to the biblical account, Adam is being presented as made from the dust. So they record that he's made from the dust, but they also add something, that he is created in the likeness of God's glory. That's not a detail in the biblical text, but a fascinating one added here in this text. So this idea that Adam shared in or somehow represented the glory of God is pretty remarkable. It also introduces the idea of the giving of knowledge to Adam prior to them eating from the tree of the knowledge of good and evil. Now, it doesn't delineate if it was knowledge of good and evil or just knowledge of the good, right? The text doesn't lay out those details for us, but it's very interesting. This idea of knowledge is something that's important. We certainly know that Adam had knowledge. He was a pretty smart guy. Mm-hmm. In fact, the biblical text, if you start putting together what the text does affirm, what it does say, there's a lot of things that Adam knew, what God revealed to him, what God was doing with him, and what Adam was doing functionally in the garden as well. So he knew a lot of things. But it's interesting, the text talks here about the knowledge that Adam had there in the Garden of Eden. And so, again, this is prior to him eating from the tree of the knowledge of good and evil. So it's some interesting, tantalizing statements here in this prayer in 4Q504. So knowledge is actually a dominant theme in this text here, in this prayer. And the author actually in this text apparently is trying to link the people praying this prayer and the knowledge that they have to Adam, their father, which is also another interesting thing that it does there. So just as Adam gave knowledge to Adam, who dwelt in the Garden of Eden, the good land, that very good land, so too God had given them, those people who dwell in the land, the promised land, which is likened to Eden. The Torah, by the way, actually does that. But here in a non-biblical text, they're doing that as well. So too God has given them knowledge. So they're descendants of Adam, and they have knowledge just as Adam had knowledge there in the Garden of Eden. So the author also reworks the giving of Adam's dominion into the Eden narrative. Maybe, we're not sure, limiting it in this case to his dominion there in Eden, as opposed to the biblical text stating that he had dominion over the ends of the earth, right? To the ends of the earth. So, but we can't say that with certainty, but it apparently is doing it in the context of Eden there. We can say that. I'll leave it at that. The Garden of Eden is depicted as a land of glory. That's a very interesting language there, in which Adam walked before God in a land of glory. So it's interesting here because you talk about the glory of God dwelling in Eden, which is present in Second Temple literature. It abounds. It's also very present within the Tanakh, within the Hebrew Bible, or the Old Testament there, in the tabernacle, in the temple, which is not coincidentally Eden recreated, where God tabernacles with his people. And that's an eschatological thrust from the beginning of creation that resounds all the way throughout the Hebrew Bible, right through the New Testament here. And of course, we're ultimately awaiting this new temple. Right. And by the way, the New Testament also deals with this idea of the people of God being the temple being built up. And this is an interesting idea at Qumran, even as they separated from the temple. And that's a common thing they have there with the New Testament. Very interesting in regard to the people of God constituting the temple of God, where God dwells. Very interesting thing there. So we see that in Qumran. But something interesting here, this idea that perhaps then that's something that's present in the Torah, because it goes on to the building of the tabernacle, which is directly linked to creation and the Sabbath, for example, the 6 days of creating, the seventh day of rest, in Exodus 31, for example, directly links that in the instructions of the tabernacle with creation. And of course, in Exodus 20, directly links the creation to the Sabbath rest as well. The author here, Qumran, also seems to be, in this case, perhaps retrofitting the glory of God there in the temple, the tabernacle, into the Eden narrative. But it's there in the Torah, I would argue, already. Also, the language that's used in retelling the prohibition there foreshadows Adam's disobedience as well. It uses language from God's accusation of him. Have you eaten from the tree, which you weren't supposed to, right? There in Genesis 3. It also recalls a later prohibition that's given to the Israelites in the Promised Land in the book of Joshua, who are likened to Adam. The idea, by the way, is to turn aside from God's commands, right? And if you turn aside from God's commands, there were commands in the Garden of Eden, and there were commands given for God's people there as part of the Mosaic covenant there, the Sinai covenant, right? Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. To turn from God's commands in either locale would result in the same consequence, expulsion from the land, exile from the land. It happened to Adam as the first people of God. It happened to the Israelites as the people of God as well. So you see this in the Bible. You see this, even this connection seems to be made here in these texts at Qumran. Even though Adam was created in the likeness of God's glory, according to the text here, he was given dominion. He was given knowledge. He walked in this land of glory with God, who tabernacled with him. He would nevertheless return to dust, right? According to the text there. And in fact, there's this idea here, right? I'll read a quote. The resulting presentation emphasizes the magnitude of God's creation and empowerment of Adam, and also brings Adam's subsequent disobedience into sharp relief, end quote. In this text, it actually recalls God's creation, the fall, and the subsequent punishment of Adam. And I want you to get this in the context of this prayer, okay? It provides the historical basis for the petition to God in the prayer, based on what happened in real history, what God has done, what man did in that context, yep, with what God had given him, right? It's in the context, it provides the historical basis for the petition of the prayer that's made on day one in this liturgical text here. It's presented no differently than the other historical events for the other days of the week of the prayers as well. So the creation, fall, and subsequent punishment of Adam is the historical basis for the prayer, the petition that's being made to God on this day. And by the way, in this presentation of the prayer, the author of this liturgical text appears to be, as I mentioned before, linking the Israelites who are dwelling in that good land, the land promised, right? Linking them to who? Adam, their father, who also dwelt in Eden, the land of glory. And there's this idea, by the way, of Adam as their father. And so the idea presented there that we all go back to Adam, or at the least in the text, you can say there that the Israelites believe that they certainly went back to Adam.
Yeah.
And so that idea seems to be present there as well. Wow. In the context of modern day discussions here, they weren't asking the question, was Adam a historical figure? No, they just, as far as the implications from this text, from 4Q504, the words of the Luminaries text, Adam was certainly understood as a historical figure. By the way, as he was also understood in other Qumran texts, I just don't have time to get into all of them today, okay? It goes beyond this with the authors here. It goes beyond this with the writer and with the adherents, the readers of this text. Faith, which is lived out, by the way, faith, which is lived out, is rooted in history. The biblical text provided for these ancient Jews the historical and theological basis for their prayers. It provided the historical and theological basis for how they understood God. Mm-hmm. It provided the historical and theological basis for how they understood their relationship to and their service to God. To put it shortly, theology mattered. Yeah. The text actually impacted their lives, the way that they lived their lives. There's another interesting thing that I want to bring up here in relationship to this very thing here that relates to what we deal with today, with creation, the flood, and dealing with creation, evolution, the debates, and all that kind of thing. Theology mattered to them, okay? So the biblical text, as I said, it impacted the way they understood and lived or ordered their lives, if you will. They ordered it based on the divinely ordered nature of the cosmos. Fascinating. 4Q instruction, another wisdom text there, which I don't have time to get into. That's another example there, how their lives were ordered according to God's divinely ordered cosmos. That is to say, the lives that we live ought to reflect the divinely ordered cosmos. That is, our lives are a living, breathing witness and a testimony to the creator of the heavens and the earth, that our lives reflect that in the fact that we work 6 days and we rest the seventh day. That's why God commanded the Israelites to do so, right? Based on the pattern in creation. This is part of the divinely ordered cosmos. And it actually directly, if you will, is infused, if you will, in some way, or intertwined with, if you will, God's relationship with his creation. The way we relate to God, the way we understand the creation account ought to impact the way we relate to our creator.
Right.
And it's what it did for the people at Qumran. Now, I want to say this. Today, as creationists, whether you're a biblical scholar, whether you're a scientist like you guys, today as creationists, we often spend a lot of time defending the historical veracity of the biblical text. And there's nothing wrong with defending the veracity of the biblical text. That is a good and noble and right thing to do. I'm not saying we shouldn't do that, okay? But what I am saying is this. At the end of the day, what remains on the table is this. What does the text mean, right? How will the biblical text impact the way we understand and live and order our lives?
Right.
And that's one of the things that is just has made a tremendous impact on me as I read the ancients, as I look at how these ancient Jewish interpreters, how they were reading it and employing the creation narrative in the context of a liturgical text, because it actually mattered to their lives. They certainly believed that Adam was historical. They certainly believed that God created. They certainly believed that Adam actually rebelled and that there was a fall and so on. But furthermore, they actually believed that God's word was calling them to an active life of service that embodied it, that embodied the word of God. It was an act of faith that lived it out. The word of God impacted their lives. The creation account was not just merely background information. That's nice, interesting stuff to debate. This is where God begins his revelation and reveals to us who he is, who we are, his intentions for humanity, and how he desires to relate with humanity. Oh, and what man did in regard to that. Oh, but God's plan in spite of that, right? And there's so many things going on here. So again, it's right for us to discuss the historical veracity of the text. But these Qumran writers and the community there seem to clearly understand the creation account as historical, as providing a historical basis for ordering their very lives. And I think that's important. Not only, we cannot stop just at, oh yeah, they believe it's a historical text. That's great. There are a lot of people that believe it's a historical text, but that doesn't change where they're going to spend eternity. Yeah. It doesn't change how they live their lives. Mm-hmm. What matters, right? We need to understand beyond that then, what do these texts mean? What is God teaching us about himself? What is he teaching us about us? What is he teaching us about his purposes for humanity? And that these texts ought to order our very lives today, just as it did for them 2,000 years ago, it ought to be doing the same thing for me today. And that is one of the takeaways for me as one of the lessons. Now, I mentioned, I don't agree with everything these authors have in their text because they were employing it for particular reasons in a particular political and religious context. Well, there's a lot of things that they did get right. There's a lot of things that we can learn from the ancients quite well.
Yeah.
So
that's great. And I think you're absolutely right, Jeremy. The more I think about this, the more I realize that what we believe as creationists is actually going to transform how we think about almost everything else. You know, as you think through all kinds of issues, including issues that are facing our society, you know, here today, you know, huge debates going raging in society about all kinds of things, including sexuality and gender or whatever. And, you know, our ideas as creationists, what we actually believe about creation is going to just change how we think about everything. And, you know, if it's not having that sort of transformative impact on our thinking, then we're not working hard enough to think through the implications of what we say we actually believe.
That's right.
About beginnings. Yeah.
Yep. Well, I fear if we get into the flood, we're going to go for another hour. So I think the best thing to do, that to me is an absolute high point of this entire discussion here, that what we believe and what the ancients believed about these texts changed their lives, right? It transformed who they were and how they lived, and that ought to do so for us as well. And if it's not, if the only thing we ever go to Genesis for is to argue about whether some verse is historical or not, or whether there's catastrophic plate tectonics hinted at, or whether hominins are human or not, if that's the only reason we ever look at Genesis, we really missed out on the most important bit. So for me, that's a great place to stop this episode. We are going to have another third episode, I'll just tell you right now, to talk about the flood. That's going to be in the future, though. We're not going to do another third episode here right now, but we will definitely come back to this in the future, because obviously this man is a fountain of wonderful information about the Dead Sea Scrolls and what they teach us about creation. Jeremy, can you tell us where would we learn more about all of this stuff? Have you written this down somewhere that we can maybe buy from Amazon or something?
Some of what I was talking about today and much more. I did a book on the Genesis creation account in the Dead Sea Scrolls. So this looks at both the biblical text there, dealing with the text critical matters, which we discussed a little bit in the first and this early part of this episode. It also deals with some of the scribal practices as well with the text. And then I deal with a number of non-biblical texts there and how they are understanding and employing the creation narrative. So the creation and the fall. So it's a lot of fun going through that. So again, these are the oldest copies of Genesis we have and the oldest extant interpretations of creation that we have. The other text I have here is called the Qumran Interpretation of the Genesis Flood. Okay. So Qumran Interpretation of the Genesis Flood. Now with the flood, remember we talked about the texts are fragmentary. There's not really any of the flood narrative preserved among the Dead Sea Scrolls, unfortunately. Mm-hmm. There's part of one verse preserved. And that's it.
Yeah.
So it's kind of hard to write a book on. Well, actually, I'm sure it can be done. one little fragment. So this one, that's the reason for the different title, Qumran Interpretation of the Genesis Flood. This deals with non-biblical text, a handful of biblical, non-biblical texts from Qumran, and how they were interpreting the flood narrative.
All right. That sounds fantastic. We're going to definitely put links to those books in the show notes and in the comments on the YouTube video when we post this up, so that everyone who is watching or listening can find out where they can find out more about everything that they've heard today, which, frankly, why wouldn't you want to learn more? It's amazing. It's amazing stuff. So
here, I just want to say thank you again to both you and Paul for having me on. And just to underscore just the importance of biblical scholarship and scientists working together, discussing ideas. These are not disjointed, you know, stay in your lane kind of stuff. We need to be working together helping each other better understand the issues at play. And so appreciate the work you guys do also with the Creation Biology Society, the Creation Geology Society. And of course, I'm with the Creation Theology Society. One of the things we are trying to model there, working together. So I appreciate you having me on. Real pleasure to talk to you guys today and look forward to the future.
Yep. Yeah, thank you. We are.
Yeah, pleasure's ours.
Yeah, that's what I was going to say. So thank you all for listening out there, or watching if you're watching on YouTube. Do remember, if you can do so, to give us a little feedback by leaving a review on one of our podcast platforms, or give us a like on Facebook, leave us a comment, tell us you love the episode, tell us you hate the episode, whatever you want to tell us. We'll listen, we'll read your comment. If you've got suggestions for future episodes, we're willing to hear that too. Always looking for good ideas of new things to talk about, even as we plot and plan for cool things that we know that you're going to love, even though you don't know you're going to love it. Surprise, the Dead Sea Scrolls are amazing. the podcast here is brought to you entirely through your contributions, the contributions in the United States. We would appreciate them going to Core Academy of Science. You can find out more about us at coresci.org/connect, where you'll find links to important content and materials that we want you to know about. And coresci.org/donate will give you a place where you've find out how to financially support the work of Core Academy and the work of our podcast. Paul, where can I support you outside of the U.S.?
You can go to our website at biblicalcreationtrust.org, and there's a donate button on our homepage that will take you to a giving page that lists all of the ways that you can give to us, including, you know, our PayPal account or direct bank transfers or whatever you want to do. And you can also find us on Facebook. We're quite active there as well. So do check us out and do give what you can to help keep the podcast going.
And we do appreciate all of those contributions that we get to keep both of the ministries going and to keep the podcast moving. Do visit us online, coresci.org/podcast. That's coresci.org/podcast to find out more about the podcast. You'll find an archive of past episodes. You can download audio versions of the podcast there as well. You'll find out about upcoming episodes, and you'll find links to our connections on social media, Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, and so forth. Next episode, not sure what it's going to be. I think it may have something to do with the radiometric dating. We seem to have thrown a couple of rocks at a hornet's nest here, so we want to come back and make sure everybody is aware that we are aware of the RATE project. So we may do that next time. But for now, we really appreciate you watching and listening, and we'll see you next time.
See you in a fortnight.
Thanks for listening to this week's episode of Let's Talk Creation. If you have questions, send them to podcast@coresci.org. That's podcast@coresci.org. And be sure to let your friends know about Let's Talk Creation. And check us out on social media. Thank you.